Oye, all persons have the business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Draw in line and give your attention, for this court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Morning, I'm Judge Castle. To my right is Judge Mormon. To my left is Judge Lance. We're here today in the matter of Boone versus Peak. It has a docket number of 08-1257. Would counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record.
Michael Horan, counsel for the appellant, Mr. Boone.
And you're with?
Oh, Linda Blauwood.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Richard Mayrick for the secretary. I'm losing my voice, I'm sorry. At council table with me is Gabriel Clemens, paralegal specialist in our office.
Okay. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Each party will have 30 minutes to present their respective arguments. Mr. Horan, you may reserve time if you wish.
Your Honors, with the court's permission, I'd like to retain 10 minutes of my allotted time for rebuttal.
You may, and you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. First issue is the question whether the VA Form 2141-38 that Mr. Boone filed with the VA Regional Office is whether or not it constitutes a notice of appeal. And the answer to that is yes, Your Honors. By filing with the Regional Office, he put the Secretary on notice of his intent to appeal the October 2007 Board of Veterans Appeals decision.
What specifically made it a notice of appeal, Mr. Horan?
Well, on the face of the document, Your Honor, in the context, the way it was written, it was clear that Mr. Boone intended it to be a notice of appeal. Even though he used the word notice of disagreement, he indicated very clearly that he intended to appeal the board's decision to the court of to this court. And the document also contains all the content requirements established by this court's rules of practice and procedure. It provided his name, his address, his phone number, VA claims number, and identified the board decision that he wished to appeal.
Doesn't it have the same content requirements that a motion for reconsideration would have?
To a large extent it does, Your Honor, except for a motion for reconsideration, the board's rules of practice require more detail. There has to be an explanation of the error committed in the board's decision. So while it doesn't meet some of the criteria of the board's reconsideration rules, it omits certain information. So, Your Honors, the VA Form 2141-38 is a notice of appeal, and the next question is whether filing it in the VA Regional Office constitutes a timely filing with this court.
How did he file it?
Well, Your Honors, I actually managed to talk to Mr. Boone yesterday by telephone, and he informed me he went to the Regional Office and met with a VA counselor, and the counselor advised him that he would send the notice of appeal to this court. Now, that's not in the record, but that's what Mr. Boone told me yesterday afternoon when I talked to him on the phone.
Well, unfortunately, counsel, I guess that's not in the record, as you pointed out.
That's true, Your Honor. So the question becomes whether that the filing of the VA Form 2141-38 in the regional office constitutes a timely filing of a notice of appeal.
Why does it matter if he went to the regional office and they said that they would mail it? What would be the difference if he went down to his state office and they said they would mail it? Or if he went to an attorney and the attorney said he'd mail it? What difference would it make?
Well, I think the difference, Your Honor, is the difference that the Federal Circuit noted in the Bailey case is the idea that veterans are led to rely on the VA to assist them, and that's what Mr. Boone apparently did. He thought that the VA would help him get the notice of appeal to this court on time. And there is a difference because the VA, that's what the VA is charged with doing. The state office really has no obligation to do that. An attorney would have an ethical obligation, but if the attorney didn't send it, then Mr. Boone would have a cause of action against the attorney. But in this particular case, I was very much affected by how close Mr. Boone described were the facts that were presented to the Federal Circuit in the Daly case. And again, that's off the record, and there's no proof of any of this. But
just
that is
out of curiosity, why would you ask your client yesterday instead of 6 months, 9 months, a year ago about the circumstances?
Well, Your Honor,
whatever you entered in appearance.
Well, Your Honor, I've been trying to contact Mr. Boone, and it was unable to do so. Yesterday was the first time that he actually returned my phone call. And I entered an appearance in his case just maybe a month ago. And so I didn't really become familiar with the case until I actually started representing Mr. Boone in the case. So the question becomes, Your Honor, whether filing the A form 214138 with the regional office constitutes timely filing. And Your Honor, Mr. Boone respectfully submits that it does. Now that Henderson has held that equitable tolling is no longer available under 7266A, this court will now have to go back and provide a new interpretation of 7266. And using the Supreme Court's decision in Houston v. Lacken as a template, this court can rule that by Mr. Boone providing the VA regional office's notice of appeal, that this constitutes timely filing with this court. And the reason for that, Your Honor, is nothing in 7266A or the remainder of that statute suggests that Congress would, it would be inappropriate for this court to rule that for the purposes, the unique circumstances of this case, that Mr. Boone filed a timely notice of appeal.
Well, Counselor, you kind of skipped over the Supreme Court precedent in the Bowles case.
Your Honors, as we indicate in our principal memorandum in this case, we believe that Bowles is not really a precedent and that Henderson misread Bowles. And there are a couple of reasons why we believe that. We understand that this court cannot overrule Henderson. And if the court would like counsel to present the reasons for believing Henderson misinterpreted Bowles, I'd be happy to provide the court with those reasons.
Well, I think the case in Bowles, as presented by the United States Supreme Court, is fairly persuasive and fairly straightforward.
Well,
and you have a jurisdictional issue here. So arguing about whether or not the concept of equitable tolling ought to be resurrected after the Supreme Court's decision seems to me to be pointless. But let's talk about your concept of agency, that somehow this court is going to make every RO and every employee of the VA our agent for purposes of receipt of what purports to be a notice of appeal. Can you expound on that just a little bit more?
Well, Your Honors, simply put, the reason the agency, the regional office, can be considered the agent here is simply that Mr. Boone put his reliance on the VA regional office, equitable tolling is no longer available, and the court can reinterpret 7266.
Okay. An agent of whom? The RO is the agent of whom is the question.
For the purposes, for the limited purposes of receipt of Mr. Boone's notice of appeal, the agent of this court. The court can deem the filing with the VA regional office to be a filing with this court.
Isn't he an agent of the secretary?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
But just like in the Houston v. Lack case, the prison officials, the Supreme Court ruled that the prison officials there constituted the agent of the court for receipt of Mr. Of the prisoner's notice of appeal. That reasoning is totally applicable here, Your Honor.
Why is the situation of a prisoner who is in federal or state control analogous to the situation of a veteran who has complete freedom of movement or presumed to have complete freedom of movement? Why are those two things analogous?
Well, Your Honor, the Federal Circuit in the Bailey case explained why they're analogous. The Federal Circuit considered Houston v. Lack and Bailey and noted that the Supreme Court was willing to give extra consideration to prisoners, but the Federal Circuit ruled that in that case that the Federal Circuit would be more likely to give better consideration to veterans because they serve the nation honorably, they're not convicted felons, and they have come to rely on the VA to assist them develop their claims. And that Bailey held that between veterans and prisoners, veterans are the ones that should get the benefit of the Houston v. Lack form of equitable tolling.
Let's go back to the statute itself. You make the argument that under the statute, this court is, I guess, free to determine, or maybe the statute doesn't specify what constitutes filing and who can serve as the person with whom the appeal is filed. I don't see how you square that argument with sub A and sub B in particular. I don't think in your brief you cited sub B. of the statute. Could you explain that to me, please?
Well, Your Honors, the sub A and sub B are specific provisions addressing how the court is to consider a notice of appeal to be delivered with the court or filed with the court. The point we wanted to make in our briefs, Your Honor, is this, that 7266A refers to that an appellant shall file a notice of appeal within 120 days of a Board of Veterans' Appeals decision.
It says with the court.
With the court. And the point we're trying to make, Your Honor, is that with the court, that that is inherently ambiguous. That
well, what about sub B then? Doesn't sub B clarify that? An appellant shall file a notice of appeal under this section by delivering or mailing the notice to the court?
That is one way to meet the filing requirements, Your Honors, but I don't believe it's the only way to meet the filing requirements. I mean, in the Houston v. Lack case, there were three different provisions in that case, all requiring the notice of appeal to be filed with the court. And the Supreme Court was willing to conclude that handing the notice of appeal to prison officials constitutes filing with the court. And now that Henderson
is... Did the statute in Houston require a filing with the court?
Yes, Your Honor, clerk of the court, 30 days. And it was 28 U.S.C. 2107. Which
2107 says unless notice of appeal is filed
and
within 30 days after the entry of such judgment, order, or decree. It doesn't say filed with the court, does it?
Well, they read it to mean that, Your Honors.
Well, I think Judge Mormon's point is well taken, at least as far as I'm concerned. You know, if Mr. Boone were, let's say, in a dementia ward of a VA hospital, then possibly the Bailey case that you're alluding to would be a little closer in terms of the absence of freedom and so forth and so on. But there's no evidence in the record to indicate that Mr. Boone was under any disability such as that. And relying upon a criminal law case, i.e. Bailey, gives me a great deal of pause, I should say.
Well, Your Honor, the Bailey case in the Federal Circuit is exactly the same as Mr. Boone's case.
If Mr. Boone were in jail, or if his freedom was otherwise restrained, possibly in a dementia ward of a VA hospital. But there's no evidence of that.
There is no evidence of that, and it's not contended. The contention simply is that the Bailey case considered Houston v. Lack and addressed the question of the two classes of potential appellants, prisoners or veterans, which ones are more entitled to get that form of equitable tolling, and Bailey held that it was veterans and not prisoners. And what Mr. Boone argues here is that reasoning, this court can employ that reasoning, along with the canvas statutory construction, that veterans benefit statutes get liberal construction, to find that when he filed his notice of appeal with the regional office, that constituted a timely filed notice of appeal with this court.
Well, Counselor, it seems to me that if we were to pursue your line of logic here, that every time a disappointed veteran went into a regional office and said, I'm going to appeal this and walk out, then we basically vitiated the intent of Congress as outlined in the statutory framework that has been outlined by Congress. We're not Congress. We're a court. We're a court of appeals. So it seems to me that following that line of logic would be very dangerous and counterintuitive as to what Congress intended. But I don't see how we would make an agent of this court out of every RO in the system. That would be 54 ROs, X number of employees. And under your theory, they would all become agents of this court. I don't think Congress intended that at all.
Well, Your Honors, the first point is that we're not talking about making all regional offices and every VA employee agents of the court. We're talking about the limited circumstances of this case where Mr. Boone gave his notice of appeal to the regional office. As to congressional intent, Your Honors, I think the timing of Irwin, Bailey, and Congress's failure to amend 7266 supports the conclusion that Congress actually intends equitable tolling to apply. In 1990, the Supreme Court issued the Irwin decision and said henceforth there will be a rebuttable presumption that equitable tolling will apply in suits against the federal government. In And in 1998, the Federal Circuit issued the Bailey case. From 1990 up until the present time, Congress has amended 72, 66 a number of times. At no time has it amended in any fashion that could be taken to mean that Congress intended to rebut the Irwin presumption.
Counselor, what circumstances, mitigating or otherwise, in this case, would militate in favor of equitable tolling? The fact that your client didn't follow the rules, he didn't understand the rules. What do we have in the record to point to that would even resurrect this concept of equitable tolling if we chose to?
Well, again, Your Honor, I think the answer is found in the Federal Circuit's opinion in Bailey. It's the idea that veterans come to rely on the VA. Mr. Boone came to rely on the VA. He thought the VA would send his notice of appeal to the court, and he didn't.
Well, that's a lot different than a hurricane wiping out your records or your communications. It's a lot different than a tornado doing that. It's a lot different than a judge saying, as in the Bowles case, I think you have X number of days to appeal. It just seems to me that even if we were to resurrect the concept of equitable tolling, the record doesn't support it in this case.
It would seem, Your Honor, that, again, that Bailey is exactly the same as this case. And in Bailey, Your Honor is absolutely correct. But here, the point, Your Honor, is that Mr. Boone relies on the VA. The VA doesn't send his notice of appeal. The VA doesn't send it back to him. It doesn't notify him. And his time period runs out. And as soon as he's made aware that the VA didn't send his notice of appeal, he immediately sent the notice of appeal to the court.
Could he send it to the court?
If we had that evidence in record in the form of an affidavit that had been submitted, say, a couple of months ago, that would be very beneficial and possibly support your position. Sorry, Judge Moorman.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I apologize. I didn't mean to step on your question. You indicated that he sent the notice of appeal to this court.
He told me yesterday, Your Honor, that he went to the VA regional office initially to file the notice of appeal, and then he sent the notice of appeal to the court when he learned that it hadn't been sent to the court.
Okay. Do we have the court file here? The green file?
I don't know.
The reason I don't mean to belabor the point, but it appears to me that the envelope that came to the court has a return address of Department of Veterans Affairs Regional Office, 345 Perry Hill Road, Montgomery, Alabama. Official business. It's this kind of a window envelope.
As I understand it, he went to the regional office and he got them to send the notice of appeal, as I understand it. But in response to your question, Judge Lentz, I'd be happy to have Mr. Boone file an affidavit if the court would like one.
Well, we're at hearing right now with the record that's before us. So you know, how you choose to present your case is one thing. I'm just telling you that we have the record as it's been presented to us, and that's what we have to rule on as a court of appeals.
Let me ask you another question to change the subject just slightly, the focus at least. The court in Henderson was dealing with a late filing at this court and no indication that there was a prior filing anywhere else, is my recollection. Here we're dealing with a filing somewhere that was within 120 days. Does that make a difference with regard to how this court ought to consider this case?
Well, I think so, Your Honor. I mean, Mr. Boone did take action within the 120-day period. Admittedly, he went to the wrong location to file his notice of appeal, but he did take action within the 120-day period. And that's actually one of the elements that is considered when equitable tolling is considered in a case.
Now, how does John R. Sand and Gravel fit into your analysis?
Well, I think that case establishes that equitable tolling is still available. I think it establishes that the Supreme Court, when it's asked to decide whether or not equitable tolling is available under various statutes, federal statutes, will actually look at the statute and make that determination. And primarily, it just stands for the proposition that equitable tolling still remains available when there is a statute involved in waiver of sovereign immunity and a granted jurisdiction to the court. And I think that's the difference here, Your Honor, from Bowles and this case, is that the statute we have here is a waiver of sovereign immunity and also a granted jurisdiction. Where in Bowles, the Supreme Court was simply looking at a statute that dealt with an Article III district court and the time to extend the time for filing an appeal to an Article III federal court of appeals. I see my time is almost up, Your Honors.
No. I'd like to follow through on the distinction in these cases. It seems to me that equitable tolling in your argument to try and continue to apply it misses the point of Bowles and sand and gravel. Bowles involved a specific language that indicated that district court may reopen the time to file an appeal for a period of 14 days after the date when it is its order to reopen is entered, but only if all the following conditions are satisfied. Very specific as to the authority of the court. Gravel involved a specific jurisdictional statute dealing with the Court of Claims, that every claim at which the U.S. Federal Court of Federal Claims has jurisdiction shall be barred unless the petition therein is filed within 6 years. Specific, dealing with the court, saying when the court could exercise. You switch to Irwin, you switch to Bowen, you switch to other cases that deal with the Title 42 that talk about a claims processing. You may file within 30 days. You may file within 30 days unless the secretary extends it. Those are completely different. You come back to our court, which is in Title 38, but specifically the creation of the court, and it states that, once I find it, notice of appeal, in order to obtain review by the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims of a final decision of the Board of Veterans Appeals, a person adversely affected shall file a notice of appeal. There's no maze. It deals directly with our authority to obtain review. It's in our own creation statute, very similar to Bowles, very similar to sand and gravel, unlike the other cases that are out there. Isn't that the real distinction that we have here? And aren't we talking about, let me add another one in here. We're talking about equitable tolling. I think Judge Mormon already alluded to it. Clearly, the statute does allow it to be filed. And clearly, well, I don't know whether clearly or not, certain opens the possibility, since it says filed with the court, since this court can sit anywhere in the land, that presumably the court could direct where a filing might be considered a filing with the court. And aren't they two different concepts? Isn't one equitable tolling,
yes, Your Honor,
and the other the authority of the court to say where and when a filing could take place?
Yes, you're exactly correct, Your Honor.
So your argument for equitable tolling seems to be stretching the case law when you might be arguing for a filing.
It's an alternative argument, Your Honor, that if the court were to decide that filing of the VA form in the regional office is not timely filing, then in order to preserve issues, Mr. Boone has presented an alternative argument.
In fact, I believe you cite in your brief to Rule 4D, if I'm not mistaken. I know
yes,
you made the analogy to the prisoners, but why not just strictly 4D, where it's jurisdictional with the courts of appeals to file. If you happen to file with one of the other tribunals, it's accepted.
Well, I think Mr. Boone doesn't read Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 4 as being applicable to this court. And the reason for that, Your Honor,
but doesn't this court have the authority to write its own rules?
Yes, Your Honor, and the court could write that rule. We cite Rule 4 in our pleadings primarily as authorities that the court can consider. They're not binding on the court, but the court can consider them. We note that in the Bailey case, the Federal Circuit had occasion to consider whether 28 U.S.C. 2107 and Rule 4 applied to this court, and the Federal Circuit held that they did not.
I see your time did go on. Are there any other questions based on that?
No. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Excuse me, Your Honor.
This is going to be more difficult for us, I think.
May it please the court. In Henderson, this court recognized that Bowles made clear that the timely filing of an appeal in a civil case is a jurisdictional requirement. Based on that Bowles mandate, this court in Henderson reviewed its jurisdictional statutes as it recognized them. It looked at 7251, where Congress established this court of record, just under Article 1, just as it had established circuit courts under Article 3. Um, noteworthy, Henderson recognized congressional specifically authorized this court to conduct upon receipt of a statutorily required notice of appeal independent judicial appellate review of the federal agency or federal department decision. It also described the appeal to this court as a claimant's first opportunity to have his claim considered by a judicial body.
Did the RO in this case effectively become the agent of the appellant for filing an appeal when it accepted this? And as I understand it, it's, at least my review indicates that there were two pages filed on the 8th of January. The second page was a statement in support of claim. There's a date stamp for receipt of that at the RO. The first page, at least the way it came to this court, the first page is starts out as a typed document addressed to the clerk of the U.S. Court of Appeals, Veterans Claims, 625 Indiana Avenue, Suite 900, Washington, D.C., and it's stamp dated received on January 8th at the RO. And then these documents show up at the court in an envelope with the return address on it of the RO. And just by way of demonstration, it's a window envelope. The only address that fits to get it to the court is on this document that was received by the RO on the 8th of January. And as a matter of fact, if you look where this is folded, when this is folded up, it fits in this envelope to have the address of the court show through that window. So against that factual background, did the RO in effect become the agent for delivery of this document to the court?
No, Your Honor. I don't think the Secretary was served with all the papers that came to the court when this was filed. I didn't know anything about the envelope. But for the purposes of this case, Your Honor, I don't think it matters whether or not the appellant filed the NOA or whether or not somebody at an RO recognized what maybe it was or could be determined to be and forwarded it on. But that did not make him an agent of this court, and there was no duty for him to do that. Whoever did that, if that's what in fact occurred, that it was sent by the RO.
What about the margin note on the statement in support of claim that is block printing that says forwarded to CABC Vacol's UPD, which I assume means update, but I don't know.
I don't know either, Your Honor, and I saw that, and once again, it's confusing, but even if you take that to be the fact that it was forwarded by the RO, it doesn't make a difference, is what the Secretary's position is.
Does the Secretary have a position as to why it took from the 8th of January of 08 until near the 22nd of April of 08 for the RO to forward something that was addressed to the court?
Your Honor, there is absolutely no evidence that I could, it would be all surmising on my part. I don't know. There's no evidence to even try to glean what that was about, why there was a delay, if it was the RO who eventually forwarded it.
Would Vacol's give us the answer to any of that? Mr. Meyer, do you have any idea?
Not that I know of, Your Honor. I don't think it would.
It sounds like your position is that if the Secretary had chained the appellant in a room and kept him from filing his appeal, that this court would nevertheless not have jurisdiction, that the remedies would be somewhere else, some litigation in the civil court or something like that, because equitable tolling does not apply.
Correct, Your Honor. And it's a bright line rule that Bowles has introduced that Irwin and Bailey line of cases did not do, making this the distinction, which Henderson finally did, about whether or not this court's statutes, including 7266, is a jurisdictional or a statute of limitations.
And you're looking to the wording of our of the statute itself, is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, Counselor, relating to Judge Castle's question, all right, let's just assume for the sake of this conversation that an agent of the Secretary did in fact say, hey, partner, I will forward this to the court. And he had 36 days to do so before the expiration of the 120 days, as I recall, and didn't do it. Now, what you're suggesting is that there's absolutely no relief that this court can provide to this veteran. Is this a case that the Secretary has considered for equitable relief?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. I don't think there's been an application
okay.
for equitable relief.
Let's then talk about enforcement. So I'm not suggesting that the RO in this case did in fact make those representations. And I don't even know if Mr. Boone expected them to forward this thing based upon the record. But it seems to me that an RO sitting here for 36 days looking at this guy's notice of appeal and doing nothing is not an acceptable course of action that we would like to perpetuate in the 54 ROs within the system.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure that the scenario you just laid out is what happens.
Okay.
That somebody at an RO who gets, I don't know how many different documents a day, maybe hundreds, maybe more, they're not attorneys, they're clerical staff. I don't think that it's also always within the realm of possibility, but I don't think it would be a matter of somebody getting this document at the RO, some clerk, understanding what it is, and putting it aside. And, of course, like you said in your hypothetical, and like Mr. Hand said, there's no indication, and he's not asserting that there was any kind of purposeful action to make this NOA be late, even if it had been sent in by the RO. But
they are agents of the Secretary, are they not?
Yes, they are.
Regardless if they have a law license or exactly what their position
are.
Is in life, they are agents of the Secretary, and the Secretary has a duty to assist.
Correct, Your Honor, but it doesn't have a duty to assist at the point where an appeal is filed to this court.
Ah, once an appeal has been filed to this court.
Correct.
Then we're into the adversarial system. Prior to that time, however, I would suggest that maybe there's an argument to be made that until this court has jurisdiction, that duty to assist may carry forward. Particularly inaction and misrepresentation, I think, would be excluded from those two things.
The Secretary would respectfully say, Your Honor, that the demarcation point is not if and when an appeal is filed. It is when the board has finished whatever it could do by issuing the decision on appeal. Its job at that point was done. By statute, that is and regulation.
What if you got a request for reconsideration?
Then that finality, it is a final decision unless a request for reconsideration is filed, and then that finality is abated. But unless there is a request, that it is a final decision.
Do you think that this could have been considered a request for reconsideration?
I think it perhaps could have been, Your Honor.
It appears to me that somebody initially categorized it as a notice of disagreement received by that stamp that's on it.
Which tells me, Your Honor, that, again, it's a clerical function. Whenever this was obtained by an RO, it's a clerk who usually gets NODs for regional office decisions and probably just assume that's what this was supposed to be.
So if this were considered by the Secretary to have been a request for reconsideration and the Secretary never made a final decision on it,
then this court would lack jurisdiction.
And presumably, once the final decision was made on the request for reconsideration, then the appellant would have an opportunity to file an appeal in this court within 120 days, am I correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
But there's never been an argument made, and even today, that's what this document was intended to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think Mr. Horan is right. Generally, motions for reconsideration are supposed to at least colorably identify what the error was supposed to have been made. in a claimant's opinion.
If we were to continue along the thought that 7266 is jurisdictional, then regardless of whether the secretary or the RO said that they would mail this document, regardless of whether he held on to it for a longer period of time, from the jurisdictional standpoint, it wouldn't matter, would it?
No, Your Honor.
But if we look at it from the standpoint of the court designating what a filing is, which I think the statute does leave open, a filing with the court. The court can sit nationally. We could designate it that if filed with the court sitting in California, it would be timely filed if it was done within 120 days. If we looked at it from that standpoint, as the Article III courts have done, a filing with the district court is stamped, and that's the date it's deemed filed with the appellate court when it's forwarded to the appellate court. So if we were to view the board as a tribunal subordinate to this court, and the IRO as an adjudicatory authority subordinate to the board, and within that chain, could we not issue a rule that said a filing with the board, properly stamped, and they certainly have that ability, filing with the RO, once stamped, forwarded to the court, would then be the date it was filed with the court, very similar to the Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 4D. Could we not do that?
Your Honor, I don't mean to be equivocal, but I'm not sure. But what I would say is that it may be doubtful in the face of the statute that the court could do that.
How could the Federal Rule of Appellate Procedures 4D be promulgated then?
Well, I think that there is a difference in the statute in those cases, Your Honor, where the statute wasn't specific or clear about where the appeal had to be filed. Like, as you pointed out earlier, just said it has to be filed within 30 days. This statute is clear. Henderson makes it clear, based on Bowles, that it's just jurisdictional, and it's not just part of the statute. I want to get this across, too. It's not just the time limit. You can't call the statute jurisdictional and then parse out parts of it. Not only, as Bowles said, the Congress can define what cases a federal court can hear, and it also defines those conditions. In the Secretary's mind, it is very clear that Congress has done that here. The conditions are basically two: 120 days filed with the court. And that's a bright line rule that was not expressed or understood from Irwin and Bowles. And Irwin and Bowles is not overruled, I understand that. My limited understanding with stare decisis means that the court doesn't need to go back and overrule those cases. Those cases are sort of like what the interpretation was at that time, and it was prospective. What I would offer to the court today is that Bowles is the new Irwin Bailey, that this is prospective, that this is how the Supreme Court says we should be treating these jurisdictional statutes at this time.
But doesn't John R. Sand and Gravel take that in a slightly different direction and say that there's room for both Irwin and Bowles, and that the analysis needs to go back to the historical interpretations of the particular statute involved?
But Your Honor, I think Henderson addressed that. And Henderson found that following the Supreme Court's guidance in John R. Sand, the Section 7266, 120-day period of filing an OA is properly classified as a jurisdiction-conferring statute because it represents a limitation on government waiver of sovereign immunity is not designed to protect defendants' case special interest in timeliness. It goes back, I think, Your Honor, to the differentiation between statute of limitations and a jurisdictional statute. Statute of limitations must be pled as an affirmative defense, and it can be waived. A jurisdictional statute cannot be waived. It cannot be agreed to or conferred on the court by agreement. It can be raised at any time by any party or sua sponte by the court. Without jurisdiction, the court is powerless to act. And I think that's the big difference.
Let me go back to a point that Judge Lance raised, and that is, if you take some of these things to their logical conclusion, and I think this is part of what we're wrestling with, at least what I'm wrestling with, it's no secret to anybody that people confuse VA and this court. I mean, every judge on this court has had the experience of having to explain to people that we're not a part of VA. That comes as no revelation to anybody in this courtroom. And it's also, I suspect, no revelation that veterans have as much trouble with that distinction as other lawyers and other judges. And in some cases, I realize those aren't mutually exclusive categories. But at any rate, I'm troubled by the idea that a veteran could erroneously give to the board or an RO something that he or she intended to be a timely filing with this court and exercise sufficient diligence, although not perfect diligence, obviously, sufficient diligence to get it filed within 120 days. And yet, because of the workload at VA, somebody doesn't get around to looking at that until after 120 days. And the net result of that process is fatal to the veteran's opportunity to appeal to this independent court.
Your Honor, if I may, I understand your concern about that, but I would respectfully say that that is a job for the legislature to actually consider that and change and allow for equitable tolling. It's clear through the history of the Judicial Review Act that it did not intend equitable tolling. And that is a legislative problem. Once again, Bowles is a bright line. And
if the legislature did not intend to allow equitable tolling, why did the legislative branch not take action after this raft of equitable tolling cases were decided by the Federal Circuit to clarify the statute?
I don't know that they... I can't answer that, Your Honor. I don't know that they had to do that or why they wouldn't have done that. I think the legislative history that we looked into a little bit that was explained in the Bailey case showed that... The legislative history showed that the House committee, the bill from the House when it made the Judicial Review Act, had a 90-day period of time to file an appeal, and it also had a clause allowing for exceptions to that for good cause. The compromise bill came out, and the good cause part of that bill was omitted. It was deleted out, and it was... What Congress did was added another 30 days to make that more beneficial. So Congress knew what it was doing. It did not have the good cause part of the statute when it was enacted, and it increased from 90 days, as the House had recommended, to 120 days to file the appeal.
Counselor, these ethereal conversations are interesting. However, let's get back to basics, all right? It would be very useful to this court to have in the record, which we do not, a letter from the RO saying, "Dear Mr. Boone, you filed this or gave it, you left it off at the RO office, you dropped it off, you filed it, whatever. And we're returning it to you because this is not the United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Sincerely yours, Mr. RO or Ms. RO or Mrs. RO. Looking to guidance to Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure Rule 26, there's a 3-day implication relative to mailing time. But the question that I think we all have is, okay, I've got this document. I don't know if it's a motion for reconsideration, if it is in fact an NOA and an appeal to the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. I'm not an agent of that court. So RO's got to do something within 36 days with that piece of paper. Maybe return it to the veteran. Dear Mr. Boone, here's your papers back. We don't have anything like that in the file that I'm aware of. Now, common sense would dictate to me, you just can't sit on this thing and wait for the 120 days to expire. And I'm not impugning necessarily an evil intent or motive to the RO. I'm just saying, under our system, I don't think you can just sit there and look at it until the 120 days have expired. You got to do something, even if it's wrong. And it seems to me that there's one or two courses of action that the RO needed to take, and one was to return it to the veteran and advise him that you're not the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, or to forward it to the court.
Your Honor, once again, as I understand Judge Mormon's concerns, I certainly understand yours. I go back to the fact that the demarcation period for duty to assist is it when a decision is issued. By statute, every board decision that is sent to the veteran or the claimant has attached to it Form 4597, which is very clear about what to do, how to protect his appellate rights. What I'm suggesting is that Congress has stated that if you do not follow these directions, this court lacks jurisdiction.
True, in ordinary circumstances, and I would agree with you. But I don't think you can sandbag the veteran. You know, and knowing, let's assume that the RO knew that this was in fact an NOA, which there's no evidence to indicate that in this case it was. And you just sit there and don't do anything until the 120 days has expired intentionally. I don't think Congress intended that either. And I'm not saying that the RO in this case intentionally did that. But it seems to me that common sense would dictate that they had an obligation to do something. Either say, is this, Mr. Veteran, a motion for reconsideration or isn't it? Yes or no. Because I think the duty to assist does extend at least to that inquiry if there's any ambiguity in terms of the instruments that are filed by the veteran, particularly a pro se.
But, Your Honor, the duty to assist extends to helping a claimant substantiate his claim for benefits. It is not a duty to assist a claimant appeal a board decision. And that's a big difference.
Is there a duty to inform the veteran of the requirement to file a notice of disagreement?
I think there is wrong.
I think if you read your own notification letters, it's very clear that certain procedures leading up to the appeals to this court are covered by the duty to assist, like informing the veteran you have to file the NOD and we need to file the SOC and all that sort of business. So I think, you know, It just seems to me that it's kind of a dangerous path that we walk if we accept your argument that the duty to assist ends at the time that the board issues its decision, because I don't know that that's the law, and I don't know that that's a fair reading of the statute. I await your comments if you have any.
I have no more comments about that, Your Honor. Like I said, Secretary's view of the duty to assist is substantiate claims for benefits.
I'd like to go back to the notice of appeal. It says it has to be filed within 120 days after the day of notice of the decision is mailed. Does this court have the authority to define what days make up that 120 days? Sundays, do they count? Holidays, do they count?
I think 120 days just means 120 days.
So if it fell on a Sunday and they didn't file it, they wouldn't have till Monday to file it?
They would have till Monday, Your Honor.
So even though the 120th day was Sunday, we could determine that you have till Monday.
I think there's legal doctrine saying that any time there's anything.
Would the legal doctrine be that we can write rules?
Well, certainly.
Which is statutory. I keep going back to the filing. I mean, we've heard this debate, you've heard the concern of the judges with regard to a situation. But as I understand your position, if equitable tolling does not apply, then the fact that there's a war going on would not delay the time in which an appeal had to be filed. And there is case law to support that, if equitable tolling doesn't apply, if it's the jurisdiction of this court. And so all the harsh situations that we're dealing with, nothing we can do about it from an equitable tolling point of view.
Your Honor, that's not a personal opinion.
No, I understand that.
That is a bright line rule.
I understand
that.
But nevertheless, we do have authority to write rules. We do have authority to determine the 120-day period, when it begins, when it ends, what days don't count. We do have authority to say when it's filed with the court. We have a common law rule that was adopted by this court. Basically, when you put it in the mail, there's a time period in which it would get to the court.
But I would respectfully assert that you don't have authority to legislate, Your Honor.
That's true.
And that's why whatever rules you may be contemplating or thinking about that you could do, they would have to be in conformance or in not contradicting the statute, the jurisdictional conferring statute.
Correct. And your view is that because Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 4D, the statute governing the appeals doesn't specifically say file with the court, that gave them that authority.
Yes, and that rule specifically said that if the appeal is misfiled at a circuit, then that's deemed to have been filed at the district court.
So if we wrote a rule and said if it was misfiled at the lower tribunal, it would be deemed to be filed here, it would be comparable, would it not?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I just, without thinking more about it, rather than standing up here.
That's fair.
I would be loath to have this come back and bite me.
It may anyway.
Whatever dicta I would offer you.
I
believe the court understands the secretary's position, and there's no other questions that...
Before we greet counsel, which is after your rebuttal, are you contagious by any chance?
This just came about the last 2 days. I don't know what it is, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, unless the court has additional questions, I don't have any additional arguments I would like to make.
I have a couple
Yes,
questions.
Your Honor.
By statute, there is the required notice given to veterans when they get a final decision from the board. And it's a pretty comprehensive notice. If that notice's specific dictates with regard to where an appeal has to be filed, where it says, how do I appeal the United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, and it says, send the notice to this address, and it says, to ensure full protection of your right to appeal to the court, you must file your notice of appeal with the court, not with the board or any other VA office. Those are pretty specific directions. Are we to simply ignore their application?
Well, Your Honor, you're absolutely correct. They're very specific, but the language about the veteran, in order to protect your appellate rights, you must file. I mean, a layperson may not be able to understand that is an unequivocal, you have to file your notice of appeal at the Court of Veterans Appeals and do not file it with us. And so and it's very little tiny print, and it's very long, and perhaps some people wouldn't spend the time actually trying to understand what the board was trying to say. But it certainly doesn't say you cannot file a notice of appeal with the VA regional office or the board.
No, it actually does say that. It says, to ensure full protection of your right to appeal to the court, you must file your notice of appeal with the court, bold, with the court in bold, and not with the board or any other VA office.
And it's the protection language, Your Honor, that I think, what does that mean? What would a layperson take that to mean? And so what I'm saying, the language is not as clear as Your Honor would say it is. That a layperson is saying that, what does that mean, protect my right to appeal? It would be far better to have big, bold letters saying, do not file your notice of appeal with the regional office. You must file your notice of appeal with the court. In conclusion, Your Honor.
So your suggestion would be that the notice might be inadequate, and if there's inadequate notice of how to appeal, then the 120-day period doesn't begin?
Your Honor, we haven't made that argument, but it's a good argument, and I'll adopt it. I think it's a very good argument. So in conclusion, Your Honors, Mr. Boone respectfully submits that the court should find that when he filed his VA 421 and 4138 with the VA regional office, he filed a notice of appeal and is timely. And unless there's any other questions, thank you for your time, Your Honor.
The case will be submitted. We'll come down and greet counsel. No, I learned my lesson.
Are we just filing out?
Yes. Yeah. Okay.